The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Coming up later on in the show, we're going to be looking some at the Democratic Party and point out just how radical this party has become, even in recent years. You think back, to the 1990s or even the early 2000s, some of the prominent Democrats back then and what they were saying, or even some of the ones that have died not too long ago. Ted Kennedy comes to mind. If he was here today, hearing what the darlings of the leftist media are out there saying, it really is astonishing. We talked some last week, I believe it was Friday's show, about Venezuela and how that Hugo Chavez himself, he'd be a good Democratic socialist if he was with us today. So we'll look further at that in the second segment, and if we have time, and I'm not sure that we will, but I also saw the story on Lewis and Clark College. Richard, in fact, is the one that pointed it out. We just thought it was kind of funny that they had this new toxic masculinity course, and this from a college. If you consider the name, their namesake, Lewis and Clark, these two that when I was a youth, you'd hear about these rugged men, these masculine men, as they carved their way through the great Northwest of the United States. So we'll look at some of that history if we have time. We'll consider that course that they have at the college, and we'll look at Lewis and Clark themselves and bring to mind some inspiring history, I think. Well, there was this interview between the head of the Saudi intelligence, or he used to be the head of Saudi intelligence. He was also a Saudi ambassador to the United States. I'll probably get his name wrong. I don't see it here. Bandar bin Sultan. He served for years as the head of the Saudi intelligence, as I said. He has this interview with the Jerusalem Post, and he's recalling the last phone call that happened between the late Saudi king, King Abdullah, and former president, Barack Obama. And according to this former Saudi ambassador, the Saudi leader, the king, he told the U.S. president, this would be Barack Obama, he said, I did not expect that after this long of a life, that I would see the day when an American president lies to me. That's what the king of Saudi Arabia evidently said to Barack Obama, an American president that just lied to him. This former ambassador said that Obama would just promise something and do the exact opposite. That's in the Jerusalem Post today. You won't read it anywhere in the American media, of course. And one can imagine their reaction. If a king anywhere on earth said about Donald Trump, he says one thing, or he promises one thing, and then he does the opposite. That's the way the Saudi king, though, felt about Barack Obama. And this article talked about what he said about the Iran nuke deal. Of course, Saudi Arabia was very much against that. But it brings out that right up to the point of it being finalized, you had the Obama administration telling Saudi Arabia, look, there's nothing to worry about here. We're not doing this. We are going to do this. We aren't doing that. And they lied. They lied. Of course, we know that they lied to the American people. And Ben Rhodes bragged about it many times. Or certainly in that New York Review article from May of 2016, I think it was. They lied, and they bragged about lying as they did it. They lied to the Saudis. But you have to go over to the Jerusalem Post to find out about that. Or maybe you can hear from some of President Trump's spokespersons, Mike Pompeo. We played some clips from him. Remember a few weeks back, he gave this speech in Cairo. That was the site of Obama's big speech, his first year as president, his new beginning speech. And Mike Pompeo was in the same city just a few weeks ago and really slammed Barack Obama, saying that his policy of retreat and defeat, those kinds of things, it's over. You've got a new administration now. And here's what Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said at this American University in Cairo, clip one.
America will not retreat until the terror fight is over. We will labor tirelessly alongside you to defeat ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other jihadists that threaten our security and yours.
Now, as I pointed out a few weeks ago, this was a strong speech, and you really did appreciate the words, particularly when considering what we had become so accustomed to hearing from the previous administration. But at the same time, as I noted a few weeks ago, the strong rhetoric, it doesn't really match what's happening on the ground. One more short clip here, clip two.
President Trump has made the decision to bring our troops home from Syria.
That was the very next statement after he said, America will not retreat until the terror fight is over. We will not retreat. And then the very next statement, President Trump has made the decision to bring our troops home from Syria. There's this story at, I forget the website, but it's by these two professors from Indiana University. And the title of it is, As U.S. Withdraws, Iran's Influence Swells. Now, Mike Pompeo really came out strong against the Iranians in that Cairo speech a few weeks ago. But again, when you look at the facts on the ground, President Trump's announced the U.S. withdrawal. And he's talked about Iran's in retreat as well. They're leaving, but they're not leaving. They're not leaving. They're setting up for the long haul. They just, as I reported last week, they just fired rockets at Israel from southern Syria. It was such a threat, Israel had to retaliate and take out some of the Iranian positions. You remember the tweet. Iran, this is where you are, and this is where you should be. They were pointing to Iran, telling the Iranians in Syria to get out. To get out of Syria. This article by these two professors, it says, the United States, not Iran, is leaving Syria, as Mr. Trump announced on December 19th. The United States is abandoning its allies and the Kurds of Syria and the Free Syrian Army. That's what's happening. That's what's happening. And this piece goes on and talks about how that, well, you had the announcement in December, the pullout announcement. And then in January, the 1st of January, the 2nd of January, where President Trump announced before his cabinet that we don't want Syria. There's nothing there for us. And then he said Iran can do whatever they want. He really didn't care. So the Secretary of State can get up and say Iran's in retreat. And it's time for us to leave. But the president pretty much admitted there on January the 2nd. There's nothing there for us. Iran can have it as far as we're concerned. And well, they're taking it. They made an announcement on January 17th that they're going to keep the military, all the revolutionary advisors, the weapons. They're going to keep all of that in Syria. They're not pulling out anything. So this article by these two professors talks about the gains they've made in Yemen. And then as far as the missile technology, all of that continues. Even with the United States pulling out of the JCPOA, still, these professors write, Tehran has continued intermediate, and long-range missile development that can reach Central Europe, North Africa, and the Indian subcontinent. U.S. officials claim that the tests violate UN Security Council Resolution 2231, yet They take no direct action. This is a violation, but there's no action taken. It says Riyadh realizes, this is Saudi Arabia, Riyadh realizes that a capricious U.S. may no longer serve as its shield and upgrades the kingdom's missile program, including construction of a missile factory southwest of Riyadh. And so there's another arms race because the U.S. is leaving. And nations like Saudi Arabia, they know that they can't rely on the U.S. anymore. And so it's easy to look at Barack Obama and say, well, look at what he was doing with Saudi Arabia. But they haven't gotten much strong support from this current administration either. That's the truth of it. It says here, Washington and Tehran tussle for influence, even in Iraq and Afghanistan, where the United States expended most of the $5.6 trillion devoted to the war on terror and lost about 13,000 American lives. Regarding the Iraq war, the U.S. Army report concludes that Iran is the sole winner. Whereas the U.S. presence in Afghanistan wanes, Iran's influence continues to grow as it recruits fighters from Afghan Shiite communities, draws Afghans into its labor force, and shelters Afghan refugees. So we're in who's the winner in Iraq? That would be Iran. Who's staying in Syria now that the U.S. is leaving? That would be Iran. Who's making great gains in Yemen? And also, this points out Afghanistan. Of course, that's Iran. The Secretary of State would do well to listen again to his own speech. Listen to clip 3.
When America retreats, chaos often follows. When we neglect our friends, resentment builds.
When America retreats, chaos follows. And so what's coming? What can we, just looking at this recent history, just looking at Secretary of State Pompeo's comments, leaving aside Bible prophecy for the moment, what can we expect with what we know about the Middle East, with what we know about just the past 10 or 15 years, or going back to 2001, let's say, what we were saying when the U.S., we were going in strong into Afghanistan. That was following 9/11. We were going to take out the Taliban. Then we invaded Iraq. We took down Saddam Hussein. It was supposed to turn out a lot differently, though. The final bit from this article, it says Trump, Pompeo, and other U.S. officials are imprudent in claiming they will expel every last Iranian boot. That's not accurate. That's not the truth. That's not what's happening. It says withdrawing the United States from serious multilateral engagement does not curtail Iran's influence. Consequently, far from pulling out, Iran expands its international footprint. It's expanding its international footprint. It's not pulling out. It's not drawing down. It's not slowing down one bit. It fired a missile at an Israeli ski resort just the other day from southern Syria. Iran is emboldened because the U.S. is in retreat. And as the U.S. retreats, just like the article title says, as it withdraws, Iran's influence swells. Its influence is growing. There's a front, it's at the top of my email, so I'm assuming it's the top feature above the fold at the New York Times today. Today's New York Times. The U.S. and Taliban agree in principle to peace framework. We're making peace with the Taliban. Just the fact that we're holding peace talks with the Taliban is scandalous. But you read through this article and, well, we're negotiating a deal so that we can leave. We're making a deal with the Taliban, this New York Times article. It says American and Taliban officials have agreed in principle to the framework of a deal in which the insurgents would guarantee Afghan territory is never used by terrorists, which could lead to a full pullout of American troops. Imagine that. What kind of a deal is this? The American troop. America agrees to pull out American troops, and the Taliban agrees that, well, we're never going to use this territory for terrorism again. How do you think that's going to work out for the United States? Just the fact that we're in peace talks with the Taliban. We certainly didn't crush them. You can't say that we went in there in 2001 and we wiped them out. The U.S. came out on top. And then the boys came home after we claimed that total victory. It's nothing like that. It says, keeping Afghanistan from reverting to the terrorist haven used by al-Qaeda to plot the September 11 attacks on the U.S., the catalyst for the nearly two-decade-old war, has long been a primary demand by American officials. It says, after 9 years of halting efforts to reach a peace deal with the Taliban, the draft framework, though preliminary, is the biggest tangible step toward ending a war that has cost tens of thousands of lives and profoundly changed American foreign policy. This is in the New York Times today, the featured story, front page news. Listen to this paragraph. It says, to many analysts of the Afghanistan conflict, the details that have emerged so far in discussions with the Taliban suggested an American desperation for a withdrawal from a war regarded as unwinnable. A war regarded as unwinnable. It is not possible for the United States of America to beat the Taliban. Front page news. A war regarded as unwinnable rather than patience for a comprehensive peace deal that could ensure some of the most basic values Americans have emphasized and so on. An unwinnable war. And so we have to sit down with the Taliban and tell them, look, we'll pull out if you promise us. They're a terrorist organization, keep in mind. If you promise us that you will no longer use Afghanistan for terrorism, to support terrorism, then we'll leave. Deutsche Welle had an opinion piece. This is from, I think, yesterday. But just listen to this paragraph. This guy's spot on. He says the Taliban have not been defeated. Remember when that was the objective? Oh, it seems like so long ago. The objective is to crush the Taliban. Not any longer. They have not been defeated. It says, on the contrary, they will be part of a political power-sharing deal with the blessing of their arch-enemy, the United States. This has the U.S. blessing. We are the Taliban's arch-enemy. And we're negotiating our surrender, basically. That's what it means. Listen to this history, though. Here's a short summary of the past 2-3 decades regarding that region. This means that after decades of fighting, they have emerged stronger than they were during the late 1990s. That's before 9/11. They have emerged stronger than they were in the late 1990s when they ruled Kabul, but were ostracized on the international stage for being reactionary Islamists. That these radicals, who are responsible for endless terrorist attacks, will now gain a pivotal position in Afghan politics, thanks to the U.S., is scandalous. It says, once again, U.S. President Donald Trump and his aides have broken a foreign policy taboo. Big scandal here. Here's another bombshell report that you probably won't hear much about today. Well, at least to its credit, at least it's on the front page of the New York Times, although that piece is just about the agreement. And the New York Times, for once, it doesn't feel like it's just a totally biased look at either side. It's just reporting on what's happening there. It's an unwinnable war. and the U.S. is trying to get out. Now, you go back and look at everything we've written about the war against terrorism, about the war in Afghanistan, the late Ron Fraser, he had a piece back in 2006 about America's forgotten war. So many people had already forgotten just after 5 years of it. This is from 2006. And Mr. Fraser was there saying, does anyone remember Afghanistan? All the focus at that time, of course, was on Iraq. He says the Taliban, this is Ron Fraser, writing in September 2006, he said the Taliban developed into an influential political religious force. It wasn't like that, though, in the 1990s. They've come out looking stronger. They have this power-sharing deal in place, thanks to the U.S. They have a say in it, in the politics of Afghanistan. That's not something that they had in the 1990s. It's pretty amazing. They've been emboldened. They've been empowered. And the United States, what do we have to show for our efforts, for all of that spilled blood, for all of that money, trillions of dollars? Well, you go back to the prophecies, and Mr. Fraser brings this out in the 2006 piece. What Mr. Armstrong said in the United States and Britain in prophecy, remember, he talked about the Korean War. He talked about the war in Vietnam. And then he said, we have won our last war. We have won our last war. Yet another prophecy coming from the mouth of Herbert Armstrong that's spot on. He was right. He was right. Mr. Fraser said this in 2006. The Taliban is back in Afghanistan. This is an article that is 12, 13 years old. The Taliban is back. It is there to stay. And with the arrival of each fighting season, gradually wear down the resistance of the U.S.-led coalition forces and American public opinion. This deliberate strategy will, no doubt, be aided by the fifth column journalists and commentators of our so often treasonous media. In the meantime, the Taliban simply believe that the Americans, like the British and Soviets, will not be staying long, and so they can afford to be patient. We wrote that at the trumpet before the Obama administration came along. This was in the middle of the Bush administration. And we told you straight up, they can afford to be patient. They'll wait us out, and we'll eventually leave. And as it happens, we're leaving, and we're giving them more power than they had before 9/11. That is an astounding turn of events. And it's happening just as the trumpet prophesied, just as we said that it would. This is Leviticus 26, verses 19 through 21. We're seeing it. We're seeing it. It's being fulfilled right before our eyes. God prophesied through Moses. He said, I will break the pride of your power, and your strength shall be spent in vain if you walk contrary unto me and will not hearken unto me. You're listening to Stephen Fleury. And this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit some feedback or a question or any comments on any of these programs, you're welcome to email us at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
So the other night, this was, I think, on 60 Minutes, the former Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz, he announced that he's considering a presidential run for 2020. And he's been a lifelong Democrat, Mr. Schultz. But he said there that he's planning to run as an independent, which has quite a few Democrats upset because they say, well, if you run as an independent, then you're going to guarantee the re-election of Donald Trump. So this throws a wrench into the Democratic platform, or I guess strategy. He hasn't, I think, made it official yet. But he is, according to this article at National Review, he is, I think he already has hired Steve Schmidt. You see him on MSNBC, I think, a fair bit. He despises Donald Trump. He worked for John McCain several years ago. And so you potentially would have two candidates there at the end of the election that would be running in strong opposition to Donald Trump. Now, what I think is most interesting about Schultz's position, why he's going to be an independent as opposed to running as a Democrat, this is from the National Review piece. It says, but what should concern Democrats the most is Schultz's motivation for running as an independent. It says, the modern Democratic Party has moved so far to the left that even a progressive businessman such as Schultz, who checks all the boxes on liberal social issues, doesn't think he has a home in the Democratic Party. And it quotes him from an interview he gave to CNBC last year. He said, I will say that it concerns me that so many voices within the Democratic Party are going so far to the left, and I ask myself, how are we going to pay for all these things? That's a good question. We've been asking that in recent days as well. How do you plan to pay for all of this? How do you plan to pay for all these things, he said, in terms of things like single payer or people espousing the fact that the government is going to give everyone a job? Free this, free healthcare, free education, free jobs, free handouts. He needs to run as an independent, he says, because the Democratic Party is too radical. It's too left-wing. That's coming from a good old progressive, like the National Review says. Peter Beinart, he had a piece at The Atlantic, the December 2018 issue, asking, will the left go too far? It's veered so sharply to the left. There's some in the party that are panicked. They're panicking over this sharp turn. Now, here again, and I can point you to another article from that same year as Ron Fraser's from the previous segment. 2006, my father, remember when Nancy Pelosi led the charge as the House of Representatives? The Democrats gained a majority there. And he had some very prescient remarks, my father did. I'll come to that in a second. But what about this claim by Mr. Schultz? That he can't compete, or he can't run for office as a Democrat because the Democrats are too far left. Well, just last night, the one getting all the news coverage this week, Kamala Harris. She's on a town hall, I think it was with Jake Tapper, talking in that exchange with some in the audience that she's intending to get rid of private health care plans. Let's just get rid of all of that. Let's eliminate all of that. That would affect something like 150 million Americans. Get rid of all of that and replace it with what? Well, a single payer system like what you have here in the UK. Look at what these candidates are promising. We're 2 years out. We're going to be hearing this constantly over the next 18 months or so. Free health care for everyone. Let's just do away with any private insurance whatsoever. Let's go all the way. Let's go the distance. And as for the trillions and trillions of dollars that all of this cost, well, like Mr. Schultz said, how do you pay for all of this? So it's like they're out there, these Democrats that are lining up for 2020, and they're trying to outdo the other. I think it was Mark Stein last night who said that they're all Bernie Sanders. And really, it's worse than that. They're even out front of Bernie Sanders. They're out in front of him. Do away with all private health care. Let's just go to a full single-payer system. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's, of course, out there saying that we need to tax people, rich people, at a rate of 70%. She said this a couple weeks ago, clip four.
Are we comfortable with a society where someone can have a personal helipad mm-hmm. while this city is experiencing the highest rates of people experiencing homelessness mm-hmm. since the Great Depression? Mm-hmm. Should those two things coexist mm-hmm. at the same time?
And of course, the answer is no. You shouldn't have someone that's rich enough to own a helicopter and have a helipad while you have all of these people, these homeless people, these poor people. So what do? We tax them to death, those rich people. 70%. We've got to share the wealth. We've got to give some of your wealth to the poor. This would have made Hugo Chavez proud. She said this, I think it might have been the same exchange, clip five.
But I do think a system that allows billionaires to exist mm. when there are parts of Alabama where people are still getting ringworm because they don't have access to public health mm. is wrong.
A system that allows billionaires to exist, they shouldn't even exist, she thinks. It's wrong. It's immoral. So the government is right there, Johnny on the spot, to take away their billions so that they can give it to others. Elizabeth Warren last week, she was talking, I think I mentioned this yesterday, she was talking about this new, or her proposal is a wealth tax. AOC is talking about a 70% tax on the rich people's income. Elizabeth Warren, she says that if you've gotten rich, and you think this through, she wants to go after property, a wealth tax on if you have a stock of gold or diamonds that you've paid for in cash that has already been taxed. If you use your taxed income to buy a yacht every year, you need to be paying 2% on that yacht. The worth of the total value of that yacht, you better pay up. Here's what Elizabeth Warren said on MSNBC last Thursday, I believe. Clip six.
So the way that this is written is to say, first of all, going to tax all your assets wherever located around the globe. So if you were planning to move them to Switzerland or some island, doesn't make any difference. They are all going to be taxed. And the second part of it is we're going to build right into the administration of this tax that it has a very high rate of monitoring, of auditing the rich people on the ultra-millionaire tax. So we're going to be out there counting them and watching them. And the third part of it is, you know, once you identify these assets, it's actually not that complicated and hard, because unlike some other places that tried to build this, this one isn't going to have a bunch of exceptions. This one says all your assets, wherever located, and we're going to keep counting.
Just like the founders drew it up a couple centuries ago, all of your assets, we're going to keep counting. There's no exceptions. The wealth that you've accumulated over the course of your lifetime, and this is wealth that, well, I mean, if you have a yacht and you got this and these things over here, if it's not liquidated, well, leave that aside. These proposals, if you break them down, even their figures, when you lay it alongside of the things that they're proposing to spend on, like universal health care, like a single-payer health care system, it's like a drop in the bucket. They're so out of touch with reality, and they're so obsessed with grabbing hold of more power. That's what it comes down to. The bottom line on the financial ledger, that doesn't even really faze them. They just want the power. They want more and more and more power. Listen to New York City Mayor Bill. This is maybe my favorite as far as the Hugo Chavez tactics. This was him at his State of the City address just a couple of weeks ago, talking about landlords and their tenants and then the property of the landlords. Clip 7.
My fellow New Yorkers, when a landlord tries to push out a tenant by making their home unlivable, a team of inspectors and law enforcement agents will be on the ground in time to stop it. We'll use every tool we have. We'll fine the landlords, we'll penalize the landlords, but if the fines and the penalties don't cut it, we will seize their buildings. And we will put them in the hands of a community nonprofit that will treat tenants with the respect they deserve.
That's Bill de Blasio saying that if the landlords aren't fair, then, and the penalties don't work and the fines don't work, we'll seize their buildings. We'll take their property. And we'll put it into the hands of a community nonprofit, whatever that means. A community nonprofit that will treat the tenants with respect, the respect they deserve. If they don't do it the way we say they should do it. You think about that abortion law that we talked about yesterday and the way that it was put in place and the comments that Governor Cuomo made when he was saying it. We're locking this down so that no one can come along later and tweak it at all. This is for the women. This is for women's rights. Well, here's the mayor of New York City warning landlords, if you don't treat the tenants right, and of course by right, that means according to the way Mayor de Blasio sees it, then we'll come take your property. We'll seize it. Those are his words. This is an American leader telling property owners that we'll take your property if you don't behave. As I say, it's not even that they're all like Bernie Sanders, as Mark Stein said. It's like they're Bernie Sanders on steroids. And they're lining up 2 years ahead of time, trying to out-Democrat each other as they swing ever more wildly to the left. Shocking. As I say, my father wrote that piece back in 2006. This was following the midterm elections where Nancy Pelosi led the Democrats on the charge. He said that this was a disaster for America. My father said, I believe these midterm elections changed American politics forever. San Francisco values will now permeate every major decision made by the American government. Here again, that was before Obama. That was before the Democrats' victory this past November. And that's before all these Democrats here in 2019 started to line up and talk about the sweeping changes they intend to make. What would my father in that article from 2006, he even said, what would leaders of the past think about these kinds of statements today? More recently, my father with that Kavanaugh article from November, he said there's a force in America that is crazed for power and intolerant of and angered by dissent. There's a force that passionately hates biblical morality and that considers abortion a right and a virtue rather than a tragedy. There's a force. We talked about some of this yesterday. The power behind it. There's a force that values political power over truth. Think about what Alexandria said just last week when criticized for her fuzzy math. She said it's more important that we're morally right as far as the argument is concerned. We don't need to be factually right. Morally right is what matters. It says, and in the Kavanaugh hearings, we got a good look at just how strong this force has become. Well, I'll just refer you to what we touched on yesterday's program, the spirit, the prince of the power of the air, and just how strong that influence is. You think of Ephesians 2 and Ephesians 6, Revelation 12, we went through some of those scriptures yesterday. Go back and listen to yesterday's podcast. I forget the exact title of that show, but it's posted, as all of our podcasts are, at thetrumpet.com. Well, it looks like we will have a few minutes to look at this new course at Lewis and Clark College on toxic masculinity. We'll get to that when we come back. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
They're offering a new course this spring at Lewis and Clark College Graduate School of Education. This is in their graduate school division. Spring 2019, it's a course on how to combat toxic masculinity in the classroom. It says the course, which is intended for educators, will encourage participants to analyze the effects of toxic masculinity and how they play out in the classrooms, communities, and lives. That's according to the course description. And as I said at the top of the show, what was funny to us in our discussion this morning as we prepped for the program was that this is coming from Lewis and Clark College. Lewis and Clark. What would these two think of this particular course at their college, or the college that bears their name? I had the gals gather a few factoids on Lewis and Clark, their expedition back in the early 1800s. They traveled nearly 8,000 miles, the entourage numbering about 4 dozen men. All men! Oh no. 4 dozen men traveling 8,000 miles, covering 10 to 20 miles a day, poling, pushing, and pulling their 10-ton keelboat and 2 dugout boats up the Missouri River. They experienced everything: dysentery, boils, tick bites, injuries of all kinds. This is switching over to the journals of Lewis and Clark. Listen to this paragraph. It says, "Nevertheless, from the unelaborated facts alone, a dramatic narrative emerges, one that is chock full of more heart-pounding near misses than most novels of the day would have dared attempt. A crumbling riverbank nearly overwhelms the keelboat. Lewis nearly falls to his death from a cliff. A confrontation with Indians that nearly turns deadly for both sides. Men nearly freeze to death on the northern plains. Buffaloes nearly trample them, and grizzly bears nearly catch them. A pirogue containing the most valuable cargo nearly capsizes. The expedition nearly takes a disastrous turn up the wrong river. A violent hailstorm nearly kills some of the men, while a flash flood nearly sweeps Clark to his death. Sacagawea nearly dies from sickness. Her people nearly abandon Lewis while crossing the Bitterroot Range, it says, nearly lost. Everyone nearly starves, and on it goes." This is from Stephen Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage. He says, "Outstanding leadership made possible the triumph over the Rocky Mountains. Lewis and Clark had welded the core of discovery into a tough, superbly disciplined family." That's what it was like, these roughly 4 dozen men. A tough, superbly disciplined family. They had built an unquestioning trust in themselves and knew the strengths and the skills of each of their men intimately. It says, "In extremely trying conditions, we suffered everything. Cold, hunger, fatigue could impart," Lewis later wrote, "as well as the keenest anxiety, excited for the fate of our expedition in which our whole souls were embarked." Says the captains managed to keep morale from collapsing. These were some manly men, Lewis and Clark. And you wonder what they would think about this new course. The spring 2019 semester on the influence of toxic masculinity in the classroom and beyond. Well, you look at these stories and many others like them, the recent one I mean, and you realize just how much work we have cut out for ourselves in, well, just as men, those of us that are men, to be the kind of man that Jesus Christ was. But also, what a responsibility we have to raise our sons to be godly men, to be godly boys and teenagers to begin with, and then men, real men, masculine men, men who will step up to their responsibilities as leaders in the home, in marriage, and family. Yesterday I went through Isaiah 3. I just focused on verses 4 and 5 mainly, but you You look at the first part of that chapter, verse 1, for behold, the Eternal, the Lord of hosts, does take away from Jerusalem. That's Israel. Those are our nations. The United States, Britain, little Judah. He takes away from Israel and Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread, the whole stay of water, the mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, and the ancient, the captain of 50, verse 3. And the honorable man, and the counselor, and the cunning artificer, and the eloquent orator, the eloquent speakers. They're all gone. The mighty man, the mighty speakers, the captains, the military men, the counselors. Satan has really flipped this society upside down. God's removed all the strong, capable men. And look at what Satan has put in their place. Verses 4 and 5, as I read yesterday, you've got leaders that are ruling or leading like children. Children just living in fantasy land, making all of these crazy promises, hoping to get the subjects of the land, addicted to handouts, addicted to socialism. Verse 9. Here's the real problem. Verse 9 says, the show of their countenance does witness against them, and they declare their sin as Sodom. They hide it not. Woe unto their soul, for they have rewarded evil unto themselves. Sin is the root of the problem. And that's right here in the middle of these well-known verses, these memory verses. Sin is the problem. Sin is the reason for verse 12, which says, as for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. There's no men leading the way. They're not even mentioned in verse 12. And that's because, like verses 1 through 3 say, that's because they're gone. The real men are gone. And so children oppress, and the women rule. This is God's take. This is prophecy for our day. God's addressing his own people. He's addressing the nations of Israel, as we saw at the start of this chapter. And of course, we saw the same problem in spiritual Israel, a lack of godly male leadership. And so it's not like the church is immune from this problem. Paul, everywhere that he went, you can see it in the letters that he wrote, he had to confront the many evils of his day and the influences of society around the brethren, like in Corinth, for example. And so it's something we have to continually fight. What Satan is broadcasting, as I discussed yesterday, all of the examples and the influences, the bad ones that we see in this world, there's so many. And we want to try to align our thinking with God's. Let this mind be in you, the mind of Christ Jesus, Philippians 2:5. Take on the mind of Christ. Put on Jesus Christ every day. And if you do that, the family that you build within your home is going to be altogether different from what we see on television, from what we see in the movies. Men ought to be leaders. They ought to be protectors. They ought to be masculine. And yet Satan is attacking. He's attacking fatherhood. He's attacking manhood. He's attacking masculinity. True masculinity. Christ-like masculinity. That's what we're talking about here. And because of what we're going up against, we really do have to make a special effort, a diligent effort, to bring up our boys to be strong, to be hardworking, to be good students, to be lovers of history, to be effective on the job, successful, ambitious, godly men. This quote from Tomorrow's World, This is from 1969. It says, while our football and basketball players get bigger and tougher, the majority of our teenage fellows are getting softer. You might see the big, tough athletes still, but you look beyond that. And of course, many of those athletes are very soft morally. They're very soft when it comes to true masculinity, but at least they look tough physically. But beyond that, we're getting softer and softer. And it's so common today to see boys and teenaged boys with no drive, no ambition, no real convictions when it comes to morality, no willingness to lead, to step up and take the lead, no desire even. And in all too many cases, not even the bodily strength that they need as young men. Well, we'll have to carry on with this study at a later time. As you know, there's a lot that we can go into. There's a lot over the years that the church has produced on this subject. The Biblical Manhood book certainly comes to mind first and foremost. That's available at thetrumpet.com. It's just an e-book. We don't have printed copies of that, but you could certainly go to thetrumpet.com literature tab and print out a copy for you, your family, and for your sons. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.